Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am a jovial Terry Foy, and he is a pouty Nick Osello.
Shut up. It's just, I know already that it's going to be, you know, anytime Notre Dame loses, it's just bap, a bap, a bap. Everyone coming out of the woodworks. Guys, I don't even know who the hell they are. Coming out and saying Notre Dame sucks. And I'm like, yeah, get it out of your system. It's honestly, Terry, the man in the arena. And some people would call what I do on Twitter braver than brave. So
I think that is what Teddy Roosevelt struggled to understand, is that with the evolution of the modern media ecosystem, the arena was actually going to transfer from the field to the internet streets. And yeah, I mean, I've shed a lot of blood in those internet streets.
Teddy Roosevelt couldn't possibly imagine the suffering that I'm going through right now.
So it's mental and physical anguish, correct?
Yes, it is. You got back out on the field today? So in my triumphant return to lacrosse, I suited up for the San Diego Lacrosse Club. It's like Mikey Diggs, Jay Carlson was on the team. You know, they're like some good players. And here's my stat line. Probably like 4 for 6 faceoffs, 1 assist, 2 rolled ankles. So I rolled an ankle
twice, or both ankles?
Same ankle twice. So I go out and I'm like, okay, there's like a ball that's going out kind of out of bounds. I'll keep it in and just take like 2 steps outside of bounds. Oh, perfect. Somebody's like wife is sitting there with her kids, and there's an empty plastic water bottle, aka the perfect ankle rolling device, sitting there. I roll it and I'm like, oh, that sucks. So like I scoop it, I pass it, and like I kind of just limp off the field. And I'm like, all right, you know, take 5 minutes off. Let's not do anything crazy. Very next face off, I go out, I take a big step on the guy's foot. He was a Navy guy, so of course he was playing like an absolute hardo. Hey, let me get toasted on the clamp and then, you know, be a hero trying to get the ground ball. Stepped on him, completely rolled my ankle, threw my stick, and took like, you know, 5 minutes to get off, made a big show about it. So 2 rolled ankles, 1 assist, 75% face-offs, and 1 very, very angry stick throw. So I think I'm officially washed up. I stepped on the scale. I'm 243. I think I'm like a fat, washed up, bald guy now. Any advice?
Congrats, man. Well, a lot. I don't know if we have enough time to go over all of the fat, washed up, bald guy advice I've got for you. The thing I did want to follow up on, though, is a couple weeks ago, Mikey unleashed a torrent of retweets of people talking about getting roasted by pro lacrosse players. Did you roast anybody today? Aside from the Navy
face-off
guy?
I mean, the opportunity didn't really present itself. Like, you know, would win the face-off turnover. Like, I was playing defense and I was, you know, like doing relatively well. I had like one dodge where I was like, damn, if anybody knew that I was clearly going to go to the middle of the field, that would have been toasting. But you know, it's like, that's kind of the issue, is there's so like the off ball space is so bad that it, like, I toast my guy and then there's somebody standing right in front of me. And like, I kind of like halfway trucked him, but I wasn't like, I am never going to be the pro, like the former pro that's going out and absolutely like destroying people. Cause the way that I destroy people isn't with flashy moves. It's with like hitting and cross checking. So my game doesn't translate well to being a story at night going like, holy shit, Nick Osello was incredible. Cause if I tried like my hardest, it would have been, holy shit, Nick Osello like gave a guy a concussion and is a complete dickhead.
Yeah.
So I kind of just go out there, and all I was thinking the entire time was just don't get hurt. And what do? I roll my ankle. When was the last time you played in a game?
I was a goalie, which means that when you retire, you retire. Because unless you're a psychopath, you don't like getting hit with the ball, and you're not good enough at any other aspect of the game to do something other than getting hit by the ball.
You're not even like a crease attackman kind of guy?
I've done that a little bit, and it's actually really fun. It made me understand why all my teammates liked lacrosse practice so much.
Because you were just like, I think, guys, I think lacrosse just kind of sucks. And then they're like, hey, try crease attackman.
Try doing anything other than getting hit with the ball.
Yeah, that seems like a really good idea. Well, I guess I'm glad that I did it, and I really am planning on like going on a diet. And I was starting to work out tomorrow. I have my groceries for meal prep, and now it's like, oh, you can't do like cardio really. So a bit of a bummer, but you know what, Terry?
Rest,
if this
ice,
is the biggest problem of the week, life's pretty
elevate.
Good. Yeah.
Enough big stalling. Get to why people are here. Georgetown 16, Notre Dame 11. The Fighting Irish fell behind 11-2 and then scored 8 straight. Oh, man, Hank does not like this roundup. Scored 8 straight. They cut it to 13-11 with 6:37 to go. And who else but Connor Moran provided 2 daggers. The Fighting Irish struggled. They could have used you. They only won 8 of 29 faceoffs, largely against Georgetown's James Riley.
Oh, okay. So here's the deal. When you go to Notre Dame, one of the biggest reasons that you go there is because it makes you a better man. And I think one of the best aspects of Notre Dame is it kind of instills this idea of charity into you. And I think that's what this game was, is listen, Georgetown hasn't been, you know, a great team, you know, historically in the last 5-10 years. Let's be charitable and give them this win. It's called the Make-A-Wish program. So Georgetown, we let you have that. Now that I got that out of my system, I mean, it comes down to two things, really. I think it was clearly face-offs. I think it plays too big of a role. I hate face-offs. So when you have a hot face-off guy, it completely changes the dynamics of an entire game, of course. But you combine that with, what is it, McElroy is the name of the Georgetown goalie?
That is correct.
Oh my God. Like a hot faceoff guy and a hot goalie. We were arguing in a group chat the other day, like, could Chaminade compete with Notre Dame if they won every single faceoff and their goalie was stopping, you know, 65, 70% of shots? Maybe. I don't know. But you run up against a two-headed monster of those two areas of the game, and that's what you choose to be hot. You really don't have a chance. You do not stand a chance if you're playing make it, take it. And if you can't, you know, if you let the other goalie get hot. I will say the good thing is of course, like, yes, the Kavanaugh brothers are great. I really like what I was seeing out of Mo Meyer and some dynamic midfield play from Notre Dame, but it's really refreshing. And just as much as the behind the backs from the Kavanaughs, I love their tenacity in the ride. And I think that could potentially be a game-changing factor late in the season. Is just, yes, you get however many more years and however many more Kavanaughs, which, you know, leads to goals and behind the backs. But when you're on a big streak and when you're, you know, coming back from down 11-2, and I think I would argue that over the last 10 years, Notre Dame has done a better job of making ridiculous, stupid comebacks like that better than anyone. And it starts with a guy like name a Kavanaugh on the ride. So the third quarter gives me hope and lets me know that, okay, this, you know, don't draw any big conclusions. This Georgetown team is legit. You just have to figure out the face-off game, because I swear to God, Terry, if we lose in overtime because we can't win a face-off in the final four, I'm just going to do a quadruple gainer off of a cliff. So is there any other insight that you're going to make me talk about?
It seems unfair that on your fourth podcast you'd have to talk about a Notre Dame loss. That's all I wanted to say.
No one has been more persecuted than the Notre Dame alumni group. And it's about time we catch a break one of these days.
Well, fortunately, you got Maryland next, so I'm sure that break is coming right around the corner.
Yep, good bounce back. So, you know, a nice, easy bye, you know, borderline a bye weekend going from Georgetown to Maryland. Also, fun fact, we'll talk about this game later, but Jeremy Noble, I'd like to give him, whether it's a shout out or a chirp, he was giving me a really hard time before the season started about Notre Dame didn't want to re-up with Denver. What are you guys, scared of competition? Well, sorry we scheduled Georgetown and Maryland, Jer. So, you know, maybe look in the mirror before you make accusatory and hyperbolic statements.
Well, it was a good year to drop Denver, potentially. All right, let's keep the pain train rolling. Last week, you went on a little bit of a rant about the fellas from State College, Pennsylvania.
Oh, my God.
And I think that they printed it out, put it up in the locker room. And, I mean, we talked about hot goalies. Alaric Fiak, 21 saves. Penn State, 10. Yale, 6. This is what people really came to this podcast to hear.
So, what a weekend for the underdogs. And I know that I, of course, have an NLL bias because that's who signs my paychecks. But, like, you even look at the upsets across the NLL, you know, specifically San Diego Seals, Panther City, and New York Riptide. And it translated over to the college lacrosse weekend. I was so ready to dogpile and say Penn State is a tragedy. Penn State should be relegated to play Liberty every game for the rest of the season. What do? They go down and take down Yale. Trying to watch this game, it really felt like two different teams. And it's always baffled my mind how teams can look so good or so bad on back-to-back weekends. I would have said if this game was going to happen late in the season, yeah, maybe chalk it up as a close loss. But for them to go from looking like a dump and the biggest, you know, disaster of a team to a contender, I mean, I almost want to hear your thoughts on it before I dive into my thesis so that I just don't kind of sound like a crazy guy.
Well, so unfortunately, this is the game that I have saved for after this podcast in order to be able to watch, because I knew that I was just going to have to devote a little bit more time than I had prior to recording. But that being said, I was talking to a bunch of people that were watching it in real time, and there were two things that jumped out to me. The first is that and Jeff Tamburini talked about this to Matt Kinnear for the postgame story, but the fact that they fell behind 2-0, and, you know, Yale, I did a lot of stuff about them in the preseason, and it all kind of stemmed from the same theme, which is that they had to learn how to win. They only have like 10 guys on their roster that have been involved in winning college lacrosse games. So they try to create all these artificial scenarios to learn how confidence gets instilled and how you come back and everything else. So they beat Villanova. They, you know, came back from a halftime deficit after leading early in the first half. So, you know, there was a lesson that was learned through that game. They jump out. Tambo talked about how when you're on a 3-game losing streak, there's just so much, he didn't say this term, I'm using it, but like confirmation bias. So if you fall behind 2-0, you're just like, oh, again? So then, basically, they respond, but then Yale comes back. And now it was 5-5, I believe, at half. So the fact that Penn State's defense, and this is the part that I'm, like, I don't even know if I'm going to watch the entire game. I think I'm just going to watch all 21 of Fiak's saves and determine from that the combination of, like, how many of these were rushed, desperate situations, basically bad offense, versus how much of it was a great closeout, great friction, end of shot clock, all that sort of stuff that was applied by the Penn State defense. And then lastly, how much of them were just incredible saves. So those are the questions that I want to have answered, because when you look at it, holding Penn State to 10 goals, that's enough to win a game. If you're Yale, you expect to win that game 11 times out of 10. Only scoring 6 is the problem. So I've got to diagnose why exactly that happened.
And I think there's, you know, I was even talking to some Seals guys last night who, you know, Doug Jamison, you know, indoor, outdoor, obviously a little bit different, but I think like the shooter on a goalie mindset is a very transferable, you know, talking point. And it comes down to two things: confidence for defense, and even more so lack of confidence for offensive players. I know that, in speaking personally from personal experience, like the goalie that I struggled against most, even when I was a shooter, which holy moly, I'm dating myself there, was Galloway. And the reason that it was Galloway, I think he's the best pure ball stopper that I've ever gone against? No, I was more confident shooting against Blaze Reardon than I was Galloway. But I remember clear as day, in one of the first shots I ever took in my professional career against, you know, he was Rattlers, I was Bayhawks. He goes, shoot it, Ocello, you know, get creative. We're a family-friendly podcast. I'll probably say this on the postgame, but shoot at Osello, you blank blank. And I was so rattled that every time I wound up, I just felt like he was already in my head. And I think that that can translate to an entire team. And when Notre Dame would get cold, it was always written on every single scout, good shots go. And you need to put them on cage and you need to, you know, blah, 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 blah. But at a certain point, like sometimes you're winding up and you're already like, oh my God, like son of a biscuit. This guy is just going to stop it no matter what. So I think that certainly had a factor. I know that that can't be statistically proven, but I really do think that when you run into a hot goalie like we saw Notre Dame do against Georgetown, it just takes the wind out of the sails and kind of just impacts the offense. The passes get a little bit harder. The shots become a little bit more intimidating, and the mistakes are magnified, and the good things that your offense are doing almost seem worthless because it's just going to hit a stone wall anyways. End rant.
Well, and to make this even crazier is that this is an Alaric Fayak who made just 2 saves and let in 10 goals against Lafayette in their opener, and he got pulled. Now, granted, and this is a huge factor, that game was inside, this game was outside. Because at the other end of the field, Jared Paquette made 16 saves. How many times do you expect your goalie to make 16 saves, only let in 10, and lose? I mean, that's just those are 2 aspects of this game that, again, I'm going to have to try to figure out what happened.
A goalie battle, but like on steroids and a little bit of crack sprinkled in. So,
correct.
Can I say that? How family friendly are we being? Can I say crack or no?
We're in podcast number 4. We'll wait until the complaints roll in and we'll adjust accordingly.
Okay, got it. So we're just going to take like an inch at a time. At least that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take an inch at a time to figure out where that line is. So I probably wouldn't have said crack last week, and now we're rolling.
Here we go. Speaking of a game that was kind of on crack, Penn 14, Duke 13 in overtime. You, again, to circle back to prior themes, I guess danced on your own grave because Duke losing to Jacksonville meant that Duke was going to win the national championship. They've now lost a second game in February. I think this is either the 4th or the 5th time they've lost to Penn in February in the last 11 or 12 years. Dylan Gurgar scored 6 goals. Nekhai Montgomery was fantastic. We're going to talk about him in a second. But Jack Schultz, and this is the part of the like narrative, quote-unquote, that I like the most. So Joe Robertson is incredibly clutch, as Notre Dame fans are familiar with. He went to St. Anne's Belfield in Charlottesville. So did Jack Schultz. They were on the same attack line as high school players. Jack Schultz playing midfield for the Quakers, brings the ball over the midline with less than a minute to go, probably like 40 seconds left in overtime, game tied 13-13. Just kind of runs down the righty wing, got underneath his defender, saw an opportunity, and put it far side.
Here's what worries me from this weekend, and I don't know if I feel like, you know, a mad scientist that's like dropping a bunch of papers and talking about how the world is going to end. Duke losing to Penn, Notre
Dame,
that's
a little too soon.
Georgetown.
That's a little too close to home.
Yeah, true. Whatever. We'll go out with a nice stiff one, stiff cocktail. But I'm starting to worry that the ACC isn't just going to be able to coast off of the strength of schedule just on the ACC, because we've had some pretty bad showings led by UNC, you know, losing to Ohio State. But this Duke team that's now lost to Jacksonville and Penn, when it gets late in the season, I'm starting to call that it's could be a little worrisome that the at-large bids aren't just going to automatically go, and there's going to be some debate on if Jacksonville and Penn and the ACC is down. So that's what I'm like overarchingly worried about Duke. The second thing is I still just think I have the biggest social media star bias, because every time I see Duke lose, I'm like, how could that have possibly happened? They have the best players because the goal highlight, the Brennan O'Neill scores, and everybody talking about Nekhai means that they must have the best players and everything like that. I don't know. I am flirting with the idea that Duke isn't as good. They just have good players. And I know that they're, as soon as I say that, they're going to tee up an incredible run. But, You know, I'm not ready to admit that the Ivies are as good or in the same league as the ACC, but it's starting to certainly feel that way. And I know that's like a not take take, and that I didn't even really talk about the game, but I think this game is like representative of where college lacrosse is at as a whole to kick off this season, if that makes sense.
Let me get you going on another hot button topic, because people love talking about conference versus conference action, but people also love talking about rules, particularly the PLL's incredibly innovative rule set. How do you feel about timeouts and overtime?
They should not exist. I hate timeouts and overtime so much. It's outside of like some face-off and some crease stuff, it's probably my least favorite thing. If for no other reason, then it just takes away so much of the excitement of, you know, like the natural excitement that's going to draw in a lacrosse fan that could be like flirting with it. You know, it also is
so rarely effective. I mean, the number of times in which I remember, you know, the famous 7 overtime Maryland, Virginia, you know, it was like win possession, timeout, fail to score, clear the ball, timeout, fail to score, overtime ends. And then it went on for 6 overtimes. And then finally, when a goal was actually scored, it was not coming out of a timeout. It just seems like such a huge percentage of overtime goals come in the flow of the offense because the defense cannot be settled. And that so infrequently, game winners in overtime are scored after a timeout. I think it benefits the defense more than the offense is what I'm saying.
I completely agree. And when you call that timeout, it was like it's a chance for the defense to get set. They know what the threats are going to be. And, you know, it almost becomes like that game theory where when
we give the offensive players a chance to think about it and a chance to get nervous and throw the ball away.
They get a chance to get nervous, but like, you know, the scouts, you know, the tendencies of all of the major players, like, yeah, late in the game, if Matt Kavanaugh has the ball, okay, I know that there's going to be a pick set for him. I know that there's going to be a number of different things. And every game that I've seen, you know, end in overtime, it's not from the perfectly drawn up offensive play. It's from the, okay, we drew up a play and then the play kind of blew up and now we just took advantage of what we found. Like, you know, I think the perfect example is, you remember Joel Tinney, Hopkins, I think, against Loyola, the fake flip into the win?
Boy, do I.
He was supposed to flip that. I was talking to him. He was supposed to flip that. He recognized that it didn't. So, like, every drawn-up play, I think it's coaches thinking that they're more important and that they have more control over a game than they actually do. So I completely agree with every point that you just said. And you will manufacture more goals pushing it off of the, you know, off of transition or even in like halfway unsettled, a slow break, than you will a set offensive play.
I mentioned that I wanted to come back to this, but Nekhai Montgomery is a very polarizing player. Some people, like our friend Dan Arestia, yeah, well, maybe not necessarily out loud, think that Arestia thinks he's like the number one midi taken in the PLL draft. A lot of the, and by a lot, I'm talking probably about a sample size of like between 5 and 10 guys of recent college players. So, you know, finished up roughly your age down to played last year. Think that he is not a top 5 midfielder in the ACC or not a top 10 midfielder nationally. And I don't see it because, first of all, it's hard to have this conversation without having a conversation about what a midfielder actually is.
Yeah.
Because on some teams, the midfielders are just the 4th, 5th, and 6th best offensive players. And then on other teams, they're the best athletes who only produce 30 points a year because they do a lot of other things, like pick up the ground ball off of face-off wings or play defense or dodge, pass shot, right? So you're not going to get credit for an assist or a goal in that scenario. Nekhai Montgomery does all of those things at a pretty high level. And then once every 5 games, he has a game like he did against Penn where, I mean, he scored 3 goals in almost the exact same way. He just ISO'd on a short stick. I think predominantly it was Piper Bond, who is a highly regarded short stick. On the right wing, gave him a jab step up top, came underneath, got back top side, two, three steps before the crease and then just finished a goal. And I think in one instance, threw an easy cross crease pass for a dunk. So he got 4 of his 6 points off of that, like, very similar play construction. And I was talking to Mike Murphy about it after the game yesterday or on Saturday, and he was saying that that was particularly frustrating because they had spent so much time working on it over the course of the week. It wasn't something that took them by surprise. It was something they knew was going to happen, and they still couldn't stop it. And to me, that is a hallmark of a good offensive player, particularly when he's doing it against a defense in Penn that is pretty highly regarded. Coming into the season, maybe there were questions about him because they weren't very experienced, but people came away from that Georgetown game thinking that they were pretty good. And I think that what Georgetown's offense did to Notre Dame vindicated that point of view. So all I'm saying is that, like, I think the hype for Nekai is real.
It's funny because you...
I'm kind of creating a straw man, but you just have to trust that there are people in my texts that actually say these things.
Yeah, first off, I think it's silly because it's... I don't know. I think the way that lacrosse is being played, especially as it relates to college going into pros, it's you need to be, generally speaking, one of the best in a specific category. It's almost like the specialization, and I draw comparisons to when people were like, who are better athletes, lacrosse players or football players? And I'm like, well, you know, obviously a wide receiver in the NFL is going to be one of the best players and, you know, the best athlete on the field and is going to be more athletic than a lacrosse player. But you compare him against, you know, a linebacker or a D lineman, it's like it just becomes more and more specialized the higher and higher you go. And I think that the specialization can be someone like Chris Kluche, who's a ridiculous finisher, or Eric Law, who has the highest off-ball IQ I've ever seen. And the almost what I would argue the number one most valuable thing is just raw athleticism. Like, you know, in the same way that you recruit an athlete like Nekai out of high school because you know that eventually you're going to be able to turn him into a good lacrosse player, you can't teach other people the same things that you're teaching Nekai because people can't do the moves. They can't separate themselves with speed. And when things start to click, he does become unguardable. Yeah, it's not surprising. Like, we had the game plan for him. But at the same time, it's like when we're preparing for Albany in college, hey, let's prepare for Lyle Thompson. But when you actually see that in person, you're like, oh, the person in practice that was playing Lyle Thompson, and like even when you give yourself scenarios, it is nothing like what happens in real life. And I think that that's Nekai's biggest asset is he is, I would argue, you know, top five athletes, just raw athletes in college lacrosse. You can't game plan against that. And if that's your separating factor for, you know, if that's your specialization, yeah, take Chris Gray's stick skills, take Pat Kavanaugh's stick skills, you know, but Nekai being the best athlete is an unbelievable valuable asset to any PLL team that you can't game plan against. And being able to transcend beyond game plans is the number one thing you can do to make a nightmare matchup from a defensive scouting perspective.
Virginia 19, Coach Gates squad 10. The Orange fell behind 8-1, cut it to 4. They traded goals 3 times, meaning that they stayed within 4 goals in a 3 kind of goal sequence stretch, but they never got the lead to 3. I did this study maybe in like 2011 of all the comebacks in NCAA tournament history, like, or from 2003 when it expanded to 16 through whenever I did this. And it was incredible how frequent 3-goal comebacks were. And then how increasingly rare 4, and then I think at that time there had only ever been 1 5-goal comeback in a game, in an NCAA tournament game. Point being that, like, if you get it within 3, you can come back. No, obviously in this instance you're trying to come back from being down 7, so it doesn't really count. But my point is that, like, never really felt like Virginia was really being threatened. And a big part of that was Petey LaSala. He really struggled against Jacob Falk last year. He went 19-28, picked up 5 ground balls, scored a goal. And then when Syracuse did get the ball, Virginia had a really good defensive game plan. They seemed to emphasize or prioritize Tucker Dordovic, where last week it seemed like Maryland emphasized Brendan Curry a little bit more. And the combination of Cole Kastner and then the defensive midfield unit that matched up against Curry helped to limit those two to shooting 2 of 21. And it felt like Dordovic's going to draw opponent's number one defender going forward.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's interesting because one of the toughest things to game plan against is a dynamic offense. And, you know, it's you know, emphasizing taking Curry out of the game being the better strategy, completely agree with. And it's almost the, hey, you would be a valuable part of a good balanced offense, but can you specifically, you two, Dordovic and Curry, can you beat us? Like, are you guys going to be the ones that if we put the game in your hands, are you guys going to be able to consistently finish? And so far that answer has been no. And I think like a weird storyline, you know, Notre Dame and, you know, this game is just falling behind 8-1 and then cutting the lead pretty significantly almost immediately after you give up that big lead, which makes kind of like talking points more difficult because, oh, Syracuse couldn't hang with Virginia. Well, they could, you know, they kind of had a roaring comeback with like four goals in a row. But, you know, as teams develop and as IQs and as the chess match gets more complicated between offense and defense, Syracuse is going to need to find a way to become more dynamic and have more threatening pieces instead of just relying on two guys who have proven themselves not to be able to consistently shoot at a high enough rate to keep them in the game and to not, you know, pretty much shoot themselves in the foot 8-1 right off. So I don't know what Coach Gate's going to do that, but can't just rely on those two anymore.
When you evaluate, how much credit do you give the team that came back based on the fact that the human psychology of the team that built the big lead is just not going to play as hard once they have a big lead?
I think it's huge because it's a character. I mean,
without, I'm sorry, you think which is huge? The ability to come back?
The ability to come back. Okay. And that is absolutely my college bias speaking right there. Because I think when you stage a comeback, it shows your versatility in a number of different ways. One being your ability to execute structured offense and your ability to execute in between the lines, your ability to execute in scrambled situations. Like, you know, take the Notre Dame 10-man ride, for example. And, you know, yes, I'll keep making this about myself. Call the cops. You know, okay, knowing that we always had that in our back pocket gave us this huge mental advantage to say, hey, listen, we are truly never out of a game. Like, we go into the 10-man, we know that we're going to be able to execute that better than the other team is going to be able to keep their composure. And so Syracuse showing a comeback like that, yeah, they still lost, yeah, this, yeah, that. But I think that pays off massive dividends for a game where they're going to need to, like, when it's coming down to overtime. You know, I think having those stress tests early on really helps a program, like, understand what it takes and getting players to know to stay in their lanes and play in their own roles. You know, I'm not doing a very good job of diving in, you know, specifically to the details. I just think it's an important stress test that allows teams to figure out what they're truly better than, you know, better at than any other team in the country. And for us, it was the 10-man ride and keeping composure in unsettled situations. And for Syracuse, it looked like it was more just, huh, when we get out of structured offense and when we know we need to score a goal, we know we're talented enough to put up four on a Virginia team, you know, very, very quickly. So take with that what you will, but I'm going to go back and watch that and have a much clearer take for next week on why Syracuse's comeback is going to be prevalent and relevant for the rest of the season.
So, Nick, very on line of cello, we are introducing a new segment, which is that you explain the meme. Uh-huh. So this is related to North Carolina's 15-10 win over Johns Hopkins. Hopkins played him tough through the first 20 minutes. It was tied 5-5, excuse me. And Caroline scored nine of the game's next 10 goals in order to put it out of reach. Chris Gray was incredible. And that is a good way to set up Joe Keegan's tweet in which he had two photos, one that looks to be something being cut out of either cookie dough or a cookie or Play-Doh, and it's an umbrella. And then the second tweet is somebody holding up the umbrella that was cut out. And the second person is apparently Chris Gray. Can you explain this meme?
Yes. So this is from the hit series Squid Games, which if you recall during the pandemic took the world by storm. This is a South Korean delicacy, which is essentially you just kind of cook sugar and some water. I think it's called like dalgomba, or I can't remember the name of the cookie, but I actually looked into it. And the whole idea is you put a brief mold so that it has an outline, but you have to carve it out. So the umbrella needs to be carved out exactly. And this is a dystopian. So if you didn't carve out the umbrella exactly, then you needed to, you know, you got like killed or something, you know, whatever it was. So this meme is saying that, okay, this Hopkins defense is perfect, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Chris Gray is in the background. You know, at the end of this scene, if I recall, like the guy dies or something bad happens. So it's like, oh, look at this Hopkins defense. Things are going good. And then you have Chris Gray ready to pretty much kill them is how that meme went. And I think you can piece it together because Chris Gray taking apart a Hopkins defense. But the entire idea is it needed to be perfect. You needed to carve it out. And Terry, between you and me, it's not a good meme. It needs too much context. I think I'm having a tough time explaining it, which is...
How do you like the segment idea?
I like it. I like it.
Puts a lot of pressure on me to come up with a good meme.
With it, and I'm going to come back and, because I was trying to, like, describe it and... Oh, yeah, it's Squid Games and it's like this super bummed out movie and it was the pandemic and it's Chris Gray and Hopkins. But next time I'm going to like bake in a completely hilarious joke. So give me one more chance at this next week and then we can go from there.
Speaking of defense, at the other end of the field, one of the things that was really interesting about this was that Carolina decided to throw zone at Hopkins particularly early. I don't know how much they stuck with it over the course of the game, but that surprised the inside lacrosse staff as we were talking about it during the game, just from the standpoint of like, is Hopkins a team you want to let get their hands free, particularly when it feels like when Joey Epstein is clicking and, you know, he's that righty wing shooter, that's when everything else opens up. But if you press out on them, make life difficult, try to turn six guys into Dodgers that have to get their own, then they're going to struggle more. And obviously Carolina came to a different decision, and presumably it was because they didn't like what they saw in terms of their man-up defense either against Ohio State or the Buckeyes and Brown. Although, you know, the goal total they let Brown get to, I think, was acceptable, obviously, in a midweek rebound win.
Yeah, I am as anti-zone as it comes. And I know, like, I think I even saw Ty Warner say, like, zone is for cowards or something like that. I do think it can be particularly useful just to throw a different look and get an offense thinking and not necessarily knowing what you're going to see. So I hope that Carolina was just experimenting with the zone. I hope it was just a phase and that they're using it as more of a curveball than as a set strategy because they have already lost trust in their defense. I think a lot of people forget it is February. Like, you still have plenty of time. If you're already giving up on your defensive, you know, on what you worked for in the fall and what you did all of preseason and what you did in the first couple games, you know, there's still a lot of fine tuning, and there is a way to make whatever defensive system you have work. And I know that that's something that drives players crazy, speaking from both personal experience and like a lot of players that get frustrated after losses. We had a decent game plan. We messed it up twice, and then now we're completely overhauling and trying to redesign and throwing in a zone and stuff like that. So I think the good spin zone is they're using it as a curveball to mix it up and get offenses kind of rattled a little bit. I think it would be a huge mistake if they started to bake it in and say, like, hey, this is when we're going to play zone because we need to, not because we have to.
Some quick hitters to finish off your Tailgate Podcast. Jacksonville 11, Denver 9. The Dolphins add a second quality win to their resume. They then turned around and played an Air Force team that was not coming off of one day's rest the way it was originally scheduled to work out. Their game for Saturday got postponed, and they added another victory. So you brought up John Galloway earlier. He's off to a great start with this squad.
And good for him. It's a program that has a lot of appealing factors. One being Coach Galloway being one of the most passionate and best goaltenders of all time. It's, you know, whether or not that translates into being a good coach, it's kind of like, you know, the Gary Gate, the Dave Petromala, the John Galloway. It's like, I don't really give a shit. It's just cool to play for someone that knows what it's like to play at the highest level. Two, Denver, I'm putting Denver on fraud watch. I really am. And I think that that's a safer take than my Penn State take last week. And then the final point is, I would like to criticize, and I hate to do this, but did you see the clip of the Jacksonville goalie scoring on Air Force?
No.
The Jacksonville goalie had a goal against Air Force, and my criticism stems from the announcers felt like, you know, I thought they were asleep for it. They were like, oh, and there's a goal from the Jacksonville goalie. I don't care if you're the Air Force, you know, homer college broadcasters. I don't care who it is. If you see a goalie score, that warrants going bananas. I don't care who you are and what your allegiances are. So that's my criticism of the day.
Luke Milliken, I'm watching this in real time. All right, so we got a face dodge at the top of the restraining line on his own end. Oh! And that was it was a bomb from the midfield.
Yeah. And did you hear?
I'm listening to you.
I'll shut up for about 5 seconds. Just listen to the broadcast.
All the way up by the 45. Wow. Because he's got to shut off number 12 there. And now it's an empty netter. And it's a goal by Jacksonville's goalie Milliken from his side.
And it's a goal.
Yeah, right? It's like a big wet fart of a broadcast. So that's – I pay attention to stuff like that now. I'm a professional.
Ohio State 17, Harvard 12. This game was played in Southwest Florida, and it was tight through halftime. And then the Buckeyes pulled away. I was watching it out of the corner of my eye. I was doing some other work. Going to go back and rewatch this one as well. But seems to me like, you know, probably a little bit of fitness and fatigue factored in.
Yeah, it just looked like Ohio State had the stable that Harvard didn't. You know, I think these are two relatively evenly matched teams. And don't be surprised if Harvard, you know, actually starts playing better and makes adjustments, just knowing how Coach Byrne operates and what's going on in his brain up there. But at the end of the day, you know, when a game's tight for so long and then the fourth quarter is the breakaway, more often than not, even if it is up on the, you know, surface level, bad stick skills or easy shots or something like that, comes down to, you know, conditioning and having the mental fortitude to keep playing within, you know, at a high level within your system when your legs are jelly and there's battery acid coursing through your veins.
Wow. That was descriptive. I really like that.
So I think I stole it from Fight Club, if I recall.
Rutgers 13, Loyola 12. I mean, this one was, honestly, it was one the Greyhounds really needed. The quirk of this one was that it started about an hour and 15 minutes late because Rutgers left their uniforms in New Jersey and needed to be driven down separately. I will say I was very impressed by the Scarlet Knights' one-on-one dodging ability. They, by my count, five of their first seven goals just came off of five different goal scorers just beating their man. If they're going to be able to show that level of athleticism in terms of their dodging going forward, this undefeated start through February is not a fluke.
No, it's not. You know, I really thought that jersey story was one of the not given enough credit to how funny it was. And the reason it is funny is just everybody loves to just dogpile on lacrosse. Even lacrosse supporters, like, you know, Rutgers leaves its jerseys and people are like, this is why lacrosse won't be taken seriously. And then it's like, oh, you know, they forgot, you know, they'll never forget to pack the gabagool, but they'll forget the jerseys. So the bits were flying. I probably should have leaned into it harder. But I think you were right that Loyola really needed, you know, they really needed this one. And it's going to be tough. I know I was a Loyola slanderer last week. But honestly, this game was closer than what I expected. I think Rutgers is sneaky, a really damn good team, and Loyola hanging with them bodes well. But, you know, they're going to need to make some serious noise in their conference tournament if they want a chance now.
Yeah, I think that's probably well said. Cornell 9, Lehigh 5. Michael Long didn't play for the Big Red in this game. Mike Sisselberger dominated possession for the Mountain Hawks. At one point, this game was 6-5, and then the Big Red scored 3 goals, I believe, in the last 7 minutes in order to pull away and set the final margin. My understanding is that this is the second consecutive game in which Cornell's offense has struggled against a zone defense. Albany played him man-to-man in the first quarter and then switched to a zone, and the Cornell offense struggled in the middle part of that game before getting used to it and settled in late. And then Lehigh did something similar, and once again, Cornell managed to figure it out and pull away late. So something to watch going forward. Expectation is that Long will be back for Ohio State.
I would be frustrated if I'm Sisselberger. Like, to completely control a game and see at the end of the game that you have 5 goals. It's like, guys, not sure what else I can do, but I personally speaking would be eyeing the transfer portal if I was him. So that's really my only take, is every time I see Lehigh dominant in the faceoffs, I'm like, oh God, like the fact that it was not a 10 goal game against NJIT is, you know, the first sign of trouble and paradise. But now it's just solidifying the fact that I all but feel bad for the kid.
Nick, anything else for this edition of the Tailgate Podcast?
No, my ankle hurts and it's stupid. And Terry, can you text me like tomorrow morning and be like, hey, you're fat. And then that can guide me to be, you know, eating a little bit healthier and like at least maybe doing some abs and maybe like a bike or something.
No, we don't need you looking like Jake Vaccaro.
Well, first off, I will never look like that. If I'm looking like that, just know that that's my cry for help. Probably call an ambulance.
I feel like you're one of those guys that's going to be like on the late night infomercial supplements at 65 and just be shredded.
You know what? That's
it's a good lane for you.
I thought that I was going to have a history of the before pictures for those.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the Tailgate Podcast. Once again, Nick Acella, we really appreciate your time. 2 down moods in a row. It's going to turn. I think it's that this time next week we are going to have an incredible positive Sunday to talk about.
Oh, my goodness. I can't wait for it. Thank you for having me on again, and I love you.
Love you, too.
Oh, yeah, let's go.
Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Ocello. Welcome to the Tailgate.